Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group, Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com, or you can call him right now at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
We do Investing Simplified.
Either of you have sound?
Yeah, we're on. I think you're listening. This is Investing Simplified. We are on. And yes, we had a little technical glitch on our board, but welcome to Investing Simplified here out of downtown Portland. And this is Kevin Stege, CPA, and I'll turn it back over to Chuck.
Okay, well, thanks, Kevin. We had a little thing on the new engineer, and Carl Jepson with the Warren Allen Law Firm's in the studio with us as well.
I wonder if that big red button had anything to do with it.
The one that says "Don't touch."
Don't touch. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's it. I always thought that was the injection seat. Yeah. You know, if you were unhappy, you just pushed a button, you went into the abyss.
Right. There you go.
Well, listen. This is Investing Simplified. This is the opportunity for you to give us a call, and we will try to stimulate you to do that. And you can give us a call at 503-417-7626, and that's 503-417-7626. Like you give me a call, make sure you're able to hear us out there. And toll-free at 800-990-0750. That's 800-990-0750. Well, listen, I'm going to get right into the market because the market's been volatile as a roller coaster. It's going up, it's going down. Which way is it going? Well, your guess is as good as mine, but I can tell you one thing. This is a true market of risk reward, and one of the biggest reasons. And Kevin, you mentioned this a few months ago too, when we were talking about different reports we've seen about what the average investor has made, what the average investor has lost or made in the market. And one of the things, the single biggest reason people lose investing, number one reason is they don't have a strategy they follow. They get into a strategy, they get emotional about the strategy, and they pull the trigger, and they get out, and they lose, and they don't come back. That's the biggest reason people lose in the market. If you have a strategy, and you know the historical history of that strategy, and you're playing that strategy, you've got to ride the strategy and let whoever you're investing with the strategy work out. Now, as long as you understand how the strategy's performed in the past, and the dips it may have taken and how long it took to recover, I have no problem with that if you're happy with the recovery time. If you don't understand the recovery time and you understand the volatility, then you shouldn't be investing in the first place. If you're not going to be willing to take the ups and downs of the risk, you shouldn't be investing.
Well, what if my strategy is to read analyst reports and news clippings on and financial advisor shows on what are the hot stocks and the cold stocks and when to buy and sell?
Well, you need to then turn on Jim Cramer and follow him because you will lose a lot of money. Yeah, then that's what you do. I mean, the thing is, historically, these guys that are on there, they're selling products and services just like a lot of advisors that run into people. And I see it all the time. People are sold things where they think there's a guarantee, they're not going to lose any money, but there is cost, there is expenses. Nobody invests for free. There is no free lunch. There's nobody I know of, Kevin, that'll do their taxes for free. Do you? I don't know any attorney that's going to give you free legal advice all the time. There's no business owner down the street from you that serves food that's going to let you come in there and eat free every day. It doesn't work that way. Everybody gets paid for their expertise. That's the way it is. And if you think you're smarter than the expert, that's what's great about our world. You can do it. You can go run and you can invest for yourself. You want to practice law? You can go on the internet and you can practice law. You want to practice surgery? You can go on the internet and practice surgery. You can do the same thing on taxes. So the reason you pay an expert is you pay an expert to have the logic in what you're doing and take the emotion out. Bring you back to logic, take the emotion out of it. I'm sure, Carl, you've had people come in and say they want to sue so-and-so and they want to just take them to court and go after them like an vengeance because they're emotionally tied into it. And you're looking at them and saying, hey, you know, according to the law, you're probably not going to win.
I have had that experience. And it's a difficult to explain sometimes because that's what we call an injury without a remedy. And, you know, and sometimes that does occur. But a lot of times the worst part is to tell someone, well, yeah, it's obvious that you've been treated wrongly here and that this was an unlawful act and it's actionable. But if you take a look at how much it's going to cost you to gain a recovery, you're going to spend more than the claim is worth, and it's still uncertain. You don't know whether you're going to win or not, and you're probably not going to collect your attorney's fees either. So, a lot of times that's true. A lot of times it's not. But
yeah, you've got to take the emotion out of it.
Absolutely.
And get back to logic. And hey, listen, speaking about emotion and logic, because of this little snafu at the start, I'd appreciate out there, if you're a listener, and whether you got a question to ask us or just to call in and say, yes, you're hearing the show, I would appreciate it if somebody would pick up the phone, call our show, so we make sure that the lines are open and we make sure that you are hearing our message. 503-417-7626, toll free 800-990-0750. And that way we for sure know it. I'm going to get right into this market, though. I want to take the emotion out of it because I want you to look at this thing logically. There's some logical things you need to be thinking about. I've been talking about it for a long time. I'm going to just kind of reiterate what I think is going on in the market. The Dow Jones closed at 17,280. So where's the Dow Jones at right now versus when we took that crash in 10907? Well, that was at 14,164.53. So in 7 years and 2+ months, we are up 22%. That works out to an average of 3.07 per year. That is not an excitable rate. The Dow Jones closed on 12/31/99 at 11,497.12. So where do we stand as of the close of yesterday? Back to 12/31/99. Well, the Dow's up 50.31%. That number sounds really big, doesn't it? Sounds really good. But if you take that by 13 years and 11 months, it's a 3.64% return. Look, that is a fact. It's not. I'm not making up numbers. I'm going back to the turn of the century. You know, that's a fair time to be looking at rates of return, back to the turn of the century. I've been saying on this show for years now, I believe very, very, very firmly that the stock market in America changed in the 90s. We became a world economy. Most of the 500 S&P stocks make more money outside the United States than they do inside the United States. We were blessed for the 80 years before we had an American market. You now are dealing in a world market. Many people were afraid to invest worldwide. I got news for you. You now are investing worldwide when you invest in the S&P 500. Same thing is true when you invest in the Dow Jones. It didn't used to be that way. It is that way now. And the key thing is, if you're going to be an investor, you had better get used to volatility because it is here to stay. I mean, we're going to continue to have volatility. Now, let's take a look at the S&P. The S&P closed at 2002.33. Now, where does the S&P stand versus where it closed on 10-9-07 of 15-65-15? Well, in those 7 years and two-plus months, it's up 27.93. Again, that's an impressive number, that number. But when you divide it by the 7 years and 2 months, it works out to 3.9%. That's an index that the 80 years before was over 10. You got to get realistic with your returns. The S&P closed on 12/31/99 at 14/69/25. So where's the S&P stand for since the turn of the century? Well, it's up 36.28. So in 13 years and 11 months, it's up 2.62%. Now, I mean, just take a look at that. 2.62 versus the Dow at 3.64. The 80 years before, the S&P outperformed the Dow by almost 20% a year. I mean, is that telling you something? It should be. You need to be aware if you're an investor. Now, let's get into the fun part about investing. How about oil? I said on the show a few months ago I thought it could go below 65 or even 60. Well, unfortunately, I was right. It is down to, it closed at 57.49 Friday. You know, I love it at the tank, but it is wreaking havoc with the markets. And I think, I truly believe it's only wreaking havoc because they have to have an excuse to say what's going on. What's really wreaking havoc is we've got deflation going on, folks. Harry Dent's been saying for years and years and years, we're entering a period of deflation. And we now have it. Home prices are lower than they were 5 years ago. That's called deflation. Wages are down. The last 6 years, as Kevin, you reported here not too long ago, wages have been down every year. That's called deflation, folks. Mm-hmm. It's not called inflation. It's called deflation. Now we see gas and oil going down into very, very low areas, and you can buy fuel cheaper. The only thing that's not getting lower yet is the price of the food we're buying, and that's going to be helped because of the shipping costs are going to get lower and lower. That hopefully will get passed on to us, the purchaser. But oil, you know, just last time I reported on 12.5 was 65.63. That is a substantial drop. Now, gold, for all the gold bugs out there, or gold mites, whatever you might be preferred to call them, I have no problem with owning a little bit of gold. I just don't think you should have more than 3 to 5% of your portfolio in it because when stuff does hit the fan, unlike a lot of people, I don't think gold's going up. I think it's going down. But gold closed at 1,222, and last report it was 1,192. Again, I think gold long-term has got one direction to go, and it's not the direction that a positive investor would want to hear. So it's down. 10-year bond rate, Kevin, have you looked at the 10-year Treasury rate?
Haven't followed it too closely.
2.1.
Wow.
2.1. Yeah. That means that if you're a very, very conservative investor and you don't want any risk at all, and I shouldn't, and we really can't say that anymore because what everybody forgets, in 2008, the Treasuries went negative. The only time in American history Treasuries went negative. And in fact, I remember us talking about that on the radio. But the fact is, that was the only time in American history Treasuries went negative. So that old adage about buy a Treasury and you never have to worry, well, you don't have to worry if you know what reality is. You know, if you live in fantasy land, you don't worry, but reality is it will fluctuate. But right now, for the joy of having a lot of money, you can buy a 10-year Treasury at 2.1%. That's telling you that the money value is not there. The investment, the intrinsic investment value is not there. Government's saying, give us your money, we'll give you 2.1 over the next 10 years. Not an exciting rate. Not an exciting rate. Well, anyway, if you got a question about this, pick up the phone, give us a call, 503-417-7626, or toll-free 800-990-0750. And hopefully somebody's hearing us out there and will give us a call and ask a question. I say this all the time to my clients, and I really mean this. There is no foolish question when it comes to your money. You got a question, pick up the phone, give us a call. We're going to take a quick break and come right back with the, I think we'll shake it up today and go to the tax investigator. And we'll bring Kevin on to talk about everybody's favorite subject, income taxes. Right? We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, wealth management.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com.
Shaking all over.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask the tax investigator, Kevin Stege, CPA and partner of the Baker Colson CPA firm. You can call Kevin at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's the CPA with the tax answers, CPA Kevin Stege.
Welcome back to Investing Simplified, and we're here on a Saturday morning having a few more technical difficulties, but we'll let the fine music.
Are you thinking about having a hamburger?
That's right. Okay, there we go. So, okay, I think we've got it squared away. Well, today on the Tax Investigator, give you a nice full dose of the Pink Panther there, and I've seen a couple news stories that I thought were of interest regarding taxes here locally, and this first one here is a Oregon Supreme Court decision that came down against a gal who was claiming that she was exempt from taxes because her wages were not income. I kind of thought a lot of those arguments had died out and that people could pretty well see that that wasn't going to fly before the Oregon Department of Revenue and or the courts. But this one was pushed on through, and it was kind of an interesting argument. Particular person didn't file their 2007 through 2010 taxes. They had claimed on with their employer that they were exempt from withholding, and so they had no withholding taken out from their paycheck, and then basically indicated that they didn't. The argument was they were exempt from withholding because they had no tax liability in previous years. Well, they didn't, and they argued that they had no tax liability because they were exempt from withholding because they didn't file tax returns. So it's a kind of a circular logic. And of course, what was kind of interesting was the taxpayer was struck down at the earlier level of the tax courts and was given a $1,000 penalty for a frivolous argument. But they appealed that on up, and the next tax court not only struck it down, but they tacked on a $2,000 penalty for continuing to pursue this argument. So Anyway, just kind of interesting.
You know, there was a period of time, you probably remember this, where there were a number of people who were claiming that that they didn't have to pay income tax because income taxes were unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a number of people who just, you know, quit paying and or never paid and making this claim. And they had a lot of other ideas too. They actually created their own courts for a while, and they would sort of in absentia try local officials and file bogus liens in the court records in the deed records and that has kind of stopped. But they used to show up in courtrooms in mass and, you know, kind of threaten folks, and it was kind of a weird thing.
Well, you know, there was a group of people that went around the country that did seminars, and they sold books on that.
Mm.
And they would send you one in the mail, and I even went to a seminar one time where they were talking about this, and they had a guy who stood up and said he was a constitutional lawyer and that taxes were totally against the Constitution, yada, yada, yada. But every time I've heard, they get struck down, mm-hmm. so... Mm-hmm. Their interpretation is a little faulty.
There's some argument out there that back when income taxes were instituted, that the amendment wasn't properly, that Congress wasn't convened properly,
right.
It wasn't ratified, so on and so forth.
Yeah,
but they
didn't use the right words in the oath or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So, but what's interesting was this particular court case, there was reference to previous opinions, and one of those court cases was here in Oregon back in 96, where a fella said that he believed that only gain or profit was taxable, but he had no gain or profit because the money he was making as a laborer was equal to the value of his labor. So he was not actually, he was only trading labor for income. And so anyway, that's an interesting argument I hadn't heard.
Yeah, last time I looked,
it didn't win.
Last time I looked, it seems to me that the basic early definition, which consists still today, of income was income is income from any source derived.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, and it's been broadly interpreted, actually. So
there is no limit to creativity.
Yes, so.
With taxpayers or their attorneys putting some of these through. But well, here's another one that's interesting. And this one here is currently in the courts, and it will have some impact if it goes through. The current law says that if you file a tax return and it is more than 3 years after the due date, or there's some other exceptions, and you're due a refund, you are not going to receive that refund. So in other words, if your 2010 tax return, which was due April 15th, 2011, is not filed by April 15th, 2014, if you don't file it in that three-year window, then if you are due a refund, you won't get it. If you owe taxes, you still have to pay them, though. So that's kind of a lot of people view that as unfair. It is what it is.
Well, it's sort of good for the goose and good for the gander, because there is a statute of limitations on it. If you do file your tax return and you owe money, and it goes, I think it's 3 years or 4 years or whatever it is, and they don't come after you, then they can't.
If they do not start collection processes within a certain time.
Yeah, within whatever the period is.
Yep.
And so I guess it kind of works both ways, that if you don't file your tax return on time, they don't have to pay you.
Mm-hmm. So currently there's a case going before the, U.S. Supreme Court? This is on a federal level, so I don't know if it's at the U.S. Supreme Court yet, but it is in the courts. And this is a fella who, that exact scenario I gave you, 2010 return was needed to be filed. He was going to get about a $1,400 refund, but he had a extenuating circumstances. He was diagnosed with late stage colon cancer and became severely depressed. Depression was a factor in his life for a number of years, and he was incapable of taking care of his financial affairs, according to him and his attorney. And so when he did file his tax return in the summer of 2014, about 3 or 4 months late, the IRS said, no, you don't get your refund. Well, they are in the process now of pursuing a case against for him to collect. And so this would be precedent setting if you could say you had extenuating circumstances or a disability or whatever, to file late and still be able to collect.
You know, that's almost what you might call an impossibility defense, because you're saying this person is so impaired that he can't manage his own affairs and nobody else was doing it for him at the time, so he couldn't possibly be liable because he couldn't have filed a tax return properly. Kind of. I mean, that's what they're arguing.
Yes.
It might work. I mean, it has some logic to it.
Yeah. So it will be, it's going to open a door. I have never seen, there's been a lot of penalties forgiven. We were fairly successful at being able to write to the IRS and say, here's the circumstances, here's what happened. They listen. Interest and the actual taxes, they don't touch. I mean, you still owe what you owe and the interest. They don't back down on that, but I've never seen ever the 3 years, if you haven't filed within that time period, I've never seen the refund come back. So if this happens, now are we into a game of saying, you know, getting doctor's notes to say I was incapable and, were you really incapable or were you just, smoking too much marijuana and really didn't care at that 3 year period? So it will be an interesting, there's going to be a whole set of rules if this goes through. So
well, there are always people who will, like you said, become very creative with stretching that. And that's one of the most interesting things about the law and in that it's always a matter of interpretation. And, you know, even though the law is a lot more statutory now and there are more rules laid down by the government, but in the old days when they had nothing but common law, it was based on common law. And so they would establish a legal principle for a particular case. And then in the next case, they would have a slightly different set of facts and they would come up and they say, well, yeah, but the rule was this, but there is an exception to the rule when. And so, you know, and it's a little harder to do that with statutes, but it can happen. But and so that's where I think sometimes the creativity of the lawyers and the judges can come in there. Sometimes they can try to do it to avoid some kind of injustice and otherwise. Some of that kind of concept came from what used to be called the Court of Equity. It still is called the Court of Equity, but it's not separate. And that was created in medieval times by the church. And basically the common law of England was so harsh and so rigid with its rules that sometimes it gave rise to some very, very difficult results. And so they appealed to the chancellor, they called it, and they
that must have been fun.
Yeah, well, it created essentially rules that were based primarily on fundamental fairness. That's why they called it equity. And so they had some sort of maxims that you know, they have things like, you know, he who seeks equity must do equity, and he who slumbers on his rights, you know, doesn't win, and it was a whole bunch of stuff that was kind of interesting. The chancellor never leaves the woolsack.
You get to use all the fun words. You've used escheat before, and now you've pulled out maxims.
Yeah, maxims are good.
Yeah, okay. Okay, well, sounds good. Well, one last small item here before the tax investigator signs off.
Oh, you're not getting off that easy. I got a question for you.
Oh, you do? Oh, yeah,
you know
I
what?
Do.
I think, okay. Actually, we've got a question for somebody from Alan is on the line. Alan, are you there? Well, we're going to see if we can get Alan there. I can't. It says Alan from Beaverton's got a question.
Okay, well, if he gets...
refunds due?
Oh, there you are, Alan. Hey, could you welcome to the show, and could you repeat your question? We didn't quite hear that.
Oh, yeah. I didn't have a question. I just had a comment and an addition to make regarding your discussion pertaining to late filings where refunds are due. I learned through sad experience that not only do you lose your refund, but the income that you earn that year is not counted towards your Social Security income. So even if you had a great year, it doesn't make any difference. It will not be included in the 35 years that they count towards calculating your Social Security.
Wow, that's good to hear. I didn't know that, but that makes I wonder. I mean, they should accept your return and all the implications on that. I would, but that's true.
I just thought your listeners might benefit from that. You know, it's pretty easy to think, oh, they owe me a refund, and I haven't filed my return. That's no big deal. I can always get my refund. And then you wake up and find, oh, I lost that refund. That's awful. Ooh, I didn't get my Social Security either.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I find that interesting.
Yeah, I mean that's one we ought to learn a little bit more about, just to see how far, you know, how wide
deep
a swath
reaching
that could cut. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I would think offhand they would accept the numbers, the implications of the numbers. They're not going to give a refund, but it seems like you should still get credit for that. But you know what seems and what isn't always
well because for one thing, if you were entitled to a refund, it means that you paid taxes. So it doesn't just mean that you paid more than you should have.
Right.
And so you would have thought they would have counted that, but I don't know how that works.
Well, I think it just goes to show. I mean, it's just important to stay on top of a few things in life, and I think taxes is one of them. You really don't want to have the government having any extra power over you, I guess.
No, they're the last creditor you ever want.
Right.
You know? That's right. So
yeah, the Social Security Administration has their rules, and that just happens to be one of their rules that's not widely broadcast. Mm. And I can see why they don't broadcast it. And I just happened to find out the hard way.
Wow. Okay. Well, appreciate that, Alan. That's a good bit of information for us to pass on to our listeners.
You bet. Okay. I'm glad to suffer the embarrassment of disclosing that for the benefit of somebody else.
Well, thank you much.
You bet. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks, Alan.
Well, okay. I got a hypothetical question for you here, Kevin. It's not all that exotic. Mm-hmm. But so we got Dorothy. We got Dorothy.
Okay.
And Dorothy owns a rental house, and she receives monthly rental income. And then, unfortunately, in June of 2014, Dorothy dies. And the heirs file a probate, and they continue to collect the rent, and they put it into the estate account. So you got half a year, you know, going in, mm-hmm. going to Dorothy, and half going to the estate. And then they close the probate, and they have gone to a tax person who told them, don't worry, she's never had to pay taxes. I've been doing her taxes for some years, and she's never had enough income to have to pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't worry about that. And so then they close the estate, and they distribute all the money, you know, all of the taxes that was deposited into the estate account and all of the assets. So my question there is, so there was income during the time of the estate. Does it go? If it was distributed to the heirs, do they have to pay it? Do they get? Are they supposed to get a 1099 kind of thing? And they would have to report that as income on their taxes for the year 2014, or can they apply it to the estate? Depending on if the deductions and things were great enough, could the estate take the money and deduct it? Or even better, could they attribute it to Dorothy, even though she's dead?
That has a number of different answers.
And you know what? We're going to take a quick break,
and
you want to listen to the show because you'll hear the answer to this question. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Very good.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com. 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and partner of the Warren Allen Law Firm, with Carl's comments. You can call Carl at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. 417-7626. Here's Carl Jepsen.
Well, welcome back to Investing Simplified. This is Carl Jepsen, but we wanted to finish up on the question that I was talking to Kevin about here, and so I'll just kind of repeat it for you very quickly. What we basically have is a deceased person who was getting rental payments on a rental property. She dies, goes through probate. Now all of the income was collected by the estate for half a year, and now they've distributed that money to the heirs, including all of the property. And the question is, who has to pay the tax? Is it the people who got it? Is it the estate itself? Or can you somehow attribute it to the decedent who wasn't having to pay taxes in the first place because she didn't make enough in a year to have to even file a return?
In this scenario, raises its head for every single decedent's tax return that has an estate that we do. And it's the allocation of income to the decedent before they died, to the estate after they died, and then from the estate to the beneficiaries and the timing of that. And really, this is just a great question, Carl, because that's a huge amount of the planning that we do for estate tax returns, a decedent's tax return, is there's all sorts of planning opportunities in this, and a lot of it comes down to elections that the executor makes, and I won't necessarily say elections, but decisions that they make or that they rely on us to help make for them. So the first step is I think she probably received bad advice not to file a tax return before, in prior years with a rental. You've got rental income and you have depreciation, and those are important to correctly report for a number of reasons, which we won't go into, but she probably had a filing requirement. Maybe not, but probably.
Well, what is the, let's assume she's over 65, she's not married. What would her basic threshold be requiring a filed return?
Over 65, not married, probably somewhere around $12,000 for federal, but for Oregon, we're talking about $3,000 or $4,000.
Really?
Yeah. So if you're going to do an Oregon return, you got to do a federal with it to figure you're starting Oregon. So you almost, it's maybe not three or four, it's maybe five or six, somewhere around there. It all depends. But still, it's a lower threshold. And if she has Social Security,
plus income, yeah, it'd be pretty hard to be under that threshold, wouldn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. So although Social Security factors in differently. So the first thing we do is we look at her. Say she died in the middle of the year, we look at the first part of the tax return, January through June, and maybe she had some medical deductions, maybe she had other things. We try to put as much income against available deductions as we can. You still have to allocate it correctly and do a proper allocation, but there's a lot that you can put into that first year, subject it to these deductions, and you have no tax. So that's the first step of tax savings. The next step is now you've got your estate. Your estate has income to report, so on and so forth. And we'll just say for illustration purposes that this is here's the first big decision. The first big decision is the estate going to end as of December of the calendar year, or is it going to go into 2015?
No, let's assume that it's going to distribute in the very latter portions of 2014.
Very good. That makes it easy. We always try to recommend a first and a final estate income tax return. And in this case, when you have a final return, the estate never pays taxes. It always gets passed out to the beneficiaries. And to check the box that it's final means there was distributions of estate assets. And so that's going to pass the income out to the beneficiaries or the loss in this case. And often, there's a tax benefit. There are excess deductions. There's deductions that a state can take that you and I can't take.
Right.
And so if that's the case, that can be really beneficial for the beneficiary's tax returns. And so
So they would deduct that as a calculation of the income that they might have to pay tax on.
Right. It comes through on a form from the estate, and it goes typically on a Schedule A to the beneficiaries. And it's excess deductions.
Now, that's something that you would generate just as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
If you were handling the tax part of it, you would generate that and send whatever information it was to the individual taxpayer so that they'd have to
do their own thing. Yeah. Exactly. Yep.
Okay. Well, that's pretty consistent.
Yeah. And you really don't want the estate, if it's an ongoing estate, you really don't want it to pay any taxes or have any losses because the losses are lost and the tax rates are really high if you don't have distributions to Benny's to pass that income out.
Right, and there's real low threshold, too, for paying tax on the trust or the estate.
The 30% tax bracket kicks in somewhere around $12,000 in taxable income.
Yeah, it goes up real quick.
Yep.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yep.
Well, that was great, Kevin. So, Carl's comments. How are we doing on time today? Are
we doing okay. We could take a quick break here. We'll come right back with Carl's comments.
Very good.
Okay.
When your legal rights and responsibilities are involved, you need attorneys you can trust. The attorneys at the Warren Allen Law Firm offer you solid legal advice and exceptional service. We practice in nearly all areas of law. We can help you with your legal needs, including wills, trusts, probate, contracts, real estate, construction, landlord rights, business, personal injury, divorce, bankruptcy, and civil litigation. The Warren Allen Law Firm has represented individuals and businesses for over three decades, and its nine attorneys have more than 200 years of combined experience practicing law. By combining experience and knowledge with individualized attention and prompt service, Warren Allen is the law firm to rely on when you are in need of legal representation. We are conveniently located at 850 Northeast 122nd Avenue near the I-205 and I-84 interchange. I'm Carl Jepson, partner with the Warren Allen Law Firm, and I invite you to contact us at 503-255-8795 or on the web at warrenallen.com.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust.
My name is Money.
Well, I know that all of us wish that our name was money, but it's not. So we're coming back to Investing Simplified, and we left off where I was going to do Carl's comments. And what I'm going to do today is sort of resurrect an old top 10. And I'm going to do that because I've had a number of requests. I've talked to a number of people and sort of social events and things here in the last few weeks, and they said, "Oh yeah, you ought to do that one again because that was very interesting." And I used some of that to help my neighbor or whatever it was. So I don't know whether it's that helpful for you, but I thought we'd talk about the top.
Hmm? Oh, these aren't the top 10 attorney jokes, are they?
No. There are no such thing.
Okay.
No. There aren't even good. There aren't 10 good ones. No.
Oh. So, I know a couple I can tell real quick. Here.
Well, okay, I'm game. You know, there aren't a whole lot of financial advisor jokes. You know, there really
there should
aren't.
Be.
We'll make some up. Anyway,
there should be, yes.
So we want to talk about the top 10 things you can do to make it easier on your kids when you die. And so, number 10, make a will or a trust. Tell your kids where it is. Number 9, make prearranged funeral or burial plans. Number 8, give important personal property to children and grandchildren before you die. Tell the whole family when you do it. This is really important because a lot of times it's those emotionally important, not necessarily economically important, tangible personal property items that cause a lot of grief and a lot of dissension in families. So if you give them away now, the other thing is do not give it away. Don't say, "Oh, I'm giving you my diamond brooch, dear," and then tomorrow, you know, cousin Tilly comes in and you say, "Hey, Tilly, I'm going to be giving you my diamond brooch." And, you know, pretty soon you've given it three or four times and you've just set up a whole big problem. So if you're going to give it to him, quite frankly, if you don't wear the thing, give it to him right now. Hand it to him. It's yours. So anyway, just a thought. They get some lifetime pleasure out of it, and they say thank you very much, Grandma, or whatever, and you avoid dissension. So,
and besides that, you get to see them get it, and get to see the smile on their face that
yeah,
they got it.
Exactly, they feel good, you feel good, and there's no misunderstanding. So, number 7, make a list of all your assets and keep it current. Tell your kids where it is. Number 6, write your own obituary. You know, I've had to write obituaries. It wasn't fun. I would have liked to have had some help doing that. And you know, I mean, I did the best I could with it, but you know, it was a little hard. So you know, at least give some ideas. Number 5, write an ethical will. And an ethical will is basically essentially it might be called a blessing. It might be called a letter to, you know, for posterity. But, you know, it might concern your religious beliefs, your philosophy, your values, your hopes, your dreams and things for them. Anyway, give it some thought. I knew a lady who wrote kind of her life story. She grew up in a little farm town and, you know, had a pretty, you know, kind of a really amazing life. And she sat down and spent months writing this thing out. And it was a really nice thing for her kids to have. So anyway, just a thought. Number four, make a list of all your living relatives and addresses, their telephones, so that your kids will know where they are. Also, tell them where the list is. Might be good to put all this stuff in the same place. Make lifetime gifts, just like Chuck was saying. Make lifetime gifts to your kids or whoever, because especially if it's either stuff or money that you know you're not going to need, you know, you give it to them, they're happy, they get to use it now, you get to see them be happy, and there's a relationship interaction with the stuff, and it makes it really nice for people, and I think it's nice to be remembered when somebody dies, but, you know, it's small consolation for the, you know, it's I think it's nicer when you say, yeah, Grandma gave me all this really cool stuff all the time during, you know, during lifetime or whatever it was. So anyway, number two, make and complete a bucket list. Tell your kids about it. Maybe they'll help you complete it. That's not a bad idea. And finally, my favorite, clean your garage. And that's number one. And why is that? Well, you know, take a look in your garage and, you know, it would be really good to get rid of all that exercise equipment that has all that dust on it. You know, you never use it. The electronic equipment that, you know, no longer even works on the voltage that's in your house, you know, that kind of stuff. Books that you said you were going to read that you know you're never going to read, you know, all 3,000 of them. You know, all of the envelopes with little rubber bands around them that have, you know, bank statements from 1952 or maybe, you know, Christmas cards that you received from, you know, your insurance agent. I don't know. Those kinds of things. Financial records that are like, you know, 25 years old, those kinds of things.
The cottage cheese carton.
The stack of cottage cheese cartons, yeah.
With the ends of string that you've saved over the years.
Yeah. But, you know, some of those things, if you've kept long enough, are of value. Like if you have those old Coke bottles, you know, those are worth some money.
You're not helping, Chuck.
I was going to say, Chuck, that's not part of this.
We call that investing in collectibles,
yeah, well,
accidentally.
That's it. And, you know, old appliances. You know, the bread maker that made one loaf of bread and you discovered that it was easier to go down to Fred Meyer and get one of their artisan bread things, you know? I mean, it's just... and the clothes that you haven't worn for, you know, 20 years. I mean, you know, it really helps. And
you mean they're not coming back?
Well, they might. They might. But, you know, most of us can't wear them if they're 20 years old, so for various reasons.
There is a problem there, yes.
So, anyway, that's the top 10, and I know this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I will tell you that one of the big things that is challenging for people is getting all of those things done, and particularly, actually, the getting rid of the personal property thing can be a real problem if there's the slightest chance that the heirs are going to have some dissension over this stuff. If you can, the better that you direct it and minimize it during your lifetime, the better, because then they can blame you instead of blaming each other. So, very good.
Well, that's great. Well, we're going to. Any other questions?
I don't think so.
Is there a quiz after this?
No.
Quiz. Well, listen, if you if you've got a question, pick up the phone and give us a call. We've had one call there today, and that was great. We'd like to get a couple more. 503-417-7626 or toll free 800-990-0750. And I think we're set for one more quick break, and we'll come back with the Knowledge Trust and wrap up the show. But we still got about 10 or 12 minutes. So if you've got a question, give us a call. We'll be right back with the Knowledge Trust.
The time to stop working is approaching, or maybe it's already arrived. CDs and money markets are paying only fractions of a point. How secure do you feel about retiring right now? Call Chuck Price. He's located right here in Portland, and he can show you how to increase your Social Security up to 67% using specific program rules and the file and suspend strategy. Chuck specializes in working with people who are either retired or are close to retiring, and he focuses on how to never run out of money during retirement. Do this today. Schedule a free 20-minute retirement plan phone consultation or schedule an appointment with Chuck himself. Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. Chuck Price at Price Financial Group Wealth Management. On the web at pfgwm.com. What you don't know can hurt you. Get that investing question or that legal question or even a tax question answered now. Call the Knowledge Trust at 503-417-7626. That's 503-417-7626. Now here's Chuck, Carl, and Kevin, the Knowledge Trust. If I
had a $1 million. Okay, we're back to Investing Simplified. If you've got a question, pick up that phone, give us a quick call, 503-417-7626, or toll free, 800-990-0750. And this is where we kind of wrap the show up in our last section. And kind of ahead of time, I'm going to go ahead and hope that maybe somebody will give us a call. But, Kevin, how does somebody get a hold of you if they need to get a hold of you?
We're at BakerColson.com. Our phone number is 503-666-5569. And we're located at 2414 Northeast Division out the east side of Gresham.
And Carl, how about, did you say a website? Did
yes,
you say,
BakerColson.com.
Okay, good.
Yes.
And we're at WarrenAllen.com and 503-255-8795. And on the web, on the email would be Jepson, J-E-P-S-E-N, at WarrenAllen.com.
And we're located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, and we're on the web at pfgwm.com. Or you can type in Price Financial Group Wealth Management .com and get us too. And you can reach us at 877-50-PRICE or locally at 503-253-3000. And you can email me at askchuck@pfgwm.com. So now you know how to get a hold of all of us. So if you do have a question during the week, give us a call. And this is kind of a time when we talk about something maybe that's happened during the week, or we discuss, you know, some things. And, you know, Kevin, you and I have ran into some people that were trying to help with their taxes, their estate planning and stuff. And one of the things I think is I try to encourage people, and Carl, you and I encounter this all the time, is that as we get older, it becomes more and more difficult to have our stuff all over the place, spread out all over the place. And I know we've had some horror stories with people having things in 40 to 60 different directions, and I'm not joking about that.
Oh, I mean, no kidding. I've had a case where there were 15 different brokerages, and real property and banks, and it was a nightmare. It was, in fact, that was one of the areas where you folks really came in handy, because I persuaded all of the heirs to come in, and basically what we did was open an accounts for everybody with you guys, and then when we finally distributed, we just distributed into the accounts rather than have to go through all of these, you know.
Yeah,
it was,
you know,
just awful.
The bad part about it too is we try to encourage clients as they get older to not hold on to those stock certificates, because each of those stock certificates you have to get re-registered when somebody dies, and even if you have it in the name of the trust, you've got to go get it re-registered. So we recommend holding it in a brokerage account, because then it's a very simple form, and it changes all the certificates at the same time.
Right, and I know that those certificates are really cool looking and all that, but I'll tell you, they don't give you any more security than having the statements and all that other stuff. And it is really, if you have to actually change the stocks, and you're trying to just cash them in or transfer them, if you're not doing it through a brokerage, it's really hard. It's an interesting process, but you write letters to these various agents, and you send it to them, and invariably the clerk has like a checklist of you know, five things, and he sends you one, two, three, four, or five as he chooses, and he usually reads the top letter of the, you know, of the letter and says, oh, that must be number two, and sends that out, and you get a bunch of forms, and it may not even apply to you. And then you try it again. And so it can be a 3-4-5 month process.
The sad thing is you're telling exactly the truth.
That is the way it goes. This is from office experience. Legal assistant says, you want me to what?
If you've never had the joy of getting a medallion guarantee.
Oh, there you go. That's right.
Well, every one of them needs that. Every stock.
For those who don't know that, a medallion guarantee is a super-duper notary that you can only get at a bank, and only if the bank person is older than 16 and knows what it is. So, you know, it's really, you know,
there's only two ways to get a notary. Not a notary, but a gold, a medallion gold. You got to go to a bank, mm-hmm. or you got to go to a brokerage firm where they have the medallion signature. And we do that for our clients as well with a medallion signature. We have a system that we can do it with, but you have to have it. And the point is, if you have a whole bunch of stock certificates and you're not consolidating them, you're looking at a train wreck when you pass away.
It makes everybody mad because it takes a lot of time, and everybody's wondering why it's taking so much time, and why does it take two or three times to deal with the agent, and it's challenging. But so, Chuck, what are some things that investors might think about before the end of the year that would be good for them?
Well, we've been saying it for some time, and I think I don't know what the market's going to do, but certainly if you've got some high capital gains and you want to take some capital gains, I think now is an excellent time to do that. Not be too greedy. Take some money off the table. When you're playing with the house's money, it's always better than playing with your own. So if you got some gains, this is a good time to take them. Might have been even better last Thursday, but it's better to take them now, because I think this market could continue to be volatile. You take some gains. If you're taking gains, you do not have the 30-day Weish rule. So you can take a capital gain, turn right around, and buy the stock again. If you're taking a loss, you can't do that. You have to wait 30 days to buy that stock. So if you've got gains in there, this is a great time to take them.
So and even then, you could turn around and buy the same stock right back
right,
if you
next
wanted
day.
To.
Absolutely, And in a volatile market, I would say if you've got some really great gains right now, I would sell them, and I would put the money in a safe place, and I'd wait for the market to kind of shake out a little bit here and see where it's going, and you might be able to buy that stock that you made some capital gains, go back and buy it at a low price. Not a bad deal. However, if you take the loss, you got to wait 30 days. And it might be well worth waiting the 30 days, too, because you might be able to buy it at a lower price, too. And remember, the price you pay for the stock is going to be there with you no matter what. It's going to hang on there. So you want to hope for it to go up so you can make a gain, of course. Gains are always better than losses. Well, listen, we're going to, you know, it's getting that time. Hope you listen to the show next week. Next week, we should have Harry Dent on the air with us. And, it's going to be interesting to talk to Harry with all the volatility in the market. So we hope to have you turn in next week. You're listening to Investing Simplified. We'll be back next week.
Financial Group Wealth Management.
Investing Simplified.